Mr. Thompson, a very quiet young man who has been staying in India for some years and studying Hindu philosophy, as an earnest student, asked Srimad Bhagavad Gita says, I am the prop for Brahman. In another place it says, I am in the heart of each one. Thus the different aspects of the ultimate principle are revealed. I take it that there are three aspects, namely, one, the transcendental, two, the immanent, and three, the cosmic. Is realization to be in any of these or in all of them? Coming to the transcendental from the cosmic, Vedanta discards the names and forms as being Maya. Again, Vedanta also said that the whole is Brahman, as illustrated by gold and ornaments of gold. How are we to understand the truth? Bhagavan, the Gita says, Brahmano hi pratishtaham. If that aham is known, the whole is known. Devotee, that is the immanent aspect only. Bhagavan, you now think that you are an individual. Outside you there is the universe and beyond. The universe is God. So there is the idea of separateness. This idea must go, for God is not separate from you or the cosmos. The Gita also says, I am the Self, O Guru Kesha, seated in the heart of all beings. I am the beginning and the middle and also the end of all beings. Thus God is not only in the heart of all, He is the prop of all, He is the source of all, their abiding place, and their end. All proceed from Him, have their stay in Him, and finally resolve into Him. Therefore, He is not separate. What's that?
My alarm didn't go off.
And then what happened?
I overslept. Which is good.
Well, don't worry about it. All is Brahman. There's no I there to oversleep.
Including the alarm.
Sri Ananda Ashram Swami's visit to Sri Ramanashrama by Shiva Rao, Dr. K. Shiva Rao. It is difficult to recall events which took place over two decades ago, but the visit of His Holiness Srimat Ananda Ashram Swamiji to Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, being out of the ordinary, is vividly imprinted in my memory. His Holiness, with a small party, was touring the south in a car. And, you know, this one, Swami, the Paramacharya from the Kanchi Parami, see his picture there near the door, she goes out?
Yes.
He walked all over India three times. He never went in a vehicle.
Wow.
His whole life, you know. Just they brought him to that, when he was a boy, they brought him to that mud in a cart. Otherwise, he never even went in a cart or a vehicle. Mm-hmm. Everywhere he walked over India for three times. Lived to be 100.
Wow. Wow.
He was a say, the Mahatma, you know. Wow. I saw him once, like Bhagavan, you could feel it. Mm. In fact, they're building a temple for him in New Jersey. They want. Mm. They built a temple for him. She knows all about him.
In New Jersey?
But they have one in also in Tamil Nadu they built. But this day he went in a car, this must be some head of some big mutt. Mm. His Holiness, with a small party, was touring the south in a car, and on his return journey arrived at Tiruvannamalai on the evening of October 1941. At that time, the late Dr. M. Anantanarayana Rao had almost completed building a house about a furlong from Sri Ramanashrama. They don't use the term anymore, furlong.
What is a furlong?
I used to know, it's like a, it's an eighth of a mile, I think. Not a quarter of a mile, but an eighth, I think.
About 500 feet.
I was living there at the time. Dr. and Mrs. Anantanarayana Rao were still in Madras and arrived the following morning. Along with a few friends, I duly received His Holiness at the roadside with Nada Swaram, that's a long horn, and conducted him to the house where a room was specially prepared for his use. The next morning at about 8 o'clock, there was a memorable audience with the Maharshi. Bhagwan was, as usual, sitting on the couch in the old hall with his back to the east. He turned to the doorway at the south. You know, they used to come in on the south side.
Okay.
South side where the Samadhi Hall is.
Ah.
In fact, you can still see that door. Yeah. When you do go around the Samadhi, yes. You look up on the left there, you'll see a door.
Ah.
And they had steps going down, but not down as far as the Samadhi Hall. It wasn't that far down back then.
Ah.
So what happened, he had trouble going up those steps, so the window on the north side, where the door is now, they made that window into a door, because he could walk straight out with those steps.
Okay, so
people used to come in and he'd be right in front.
Mm.
You walk in and he's sitting right there.
Oh, wow.
You know, like how it used to be.
Not where it is now.
The door is not where it is now.
No, but he was sitting...
Same place. But you come in, from the Samadhi side.
Uh-huh.
You'll be facing it. So that's how he describes it here. So he turned to the doorway at the south the moment His Holiness entered. They greeted each other with smiles. His Holiness sat on a seat on the floor. For over half an hour, they merely gazed at each other. No words were exchanged. The audience then terminated. I mean, they're all died. They left, I guess. You know.
Who is His Holiness?
They call him Ananda Ashram Swami. From the north. Must be some mutt or something. He was on a South Indian tour. I must add that for vast numbers of persons, a darshan and the silent gaze of Bhagavan solved problems and communicated peace. Of course, when any sadhakas asked questions, they were appropriately, though briefly, answered. Bhagavan usually spoke in Tamil, and some devotee nearby acted as interpreter for those who did not know the language. At about 4 p.m. the same day, or the next, I accompanied His Holiness and the party, all barefooted, as usual, on a pradakshina around the holy Arunachala hill, which covers about 8.5 miles. On our way back, we entered the great Arunachaleshwar temple and offered archana at the deities. Dr. M. Anantanarayana Rao and I did pada puja to His Holiness during his stay. His Holiness was persuaded to stay for 3 days. Though he had programmed for only 2. It was an extremely happy occasion for all of us. So Sri Bhagavan's triumphant gaze, this is Professor Anar Krishnamurti Iyer. You know, he's in that video. The older man said he felt like a bomb exploding under his seat.
Yes.
This is the guy. We know him pretty well. He wrote a manuscript about his experiences, and I read it when it was in the notebook. And then they sent it to the publisher to lay it out and print it. They lost it. And they thought, we lost the whole thing, you know what I mean? Because he died after that. And,
oh, no.
And, but then we didn't know David Godman had Xeroxed it. So later he put it in one of his, he never told anybody. He put it in his book, you know, Power Presence. You know.
No.
He didn't tell anybody because he's been collecting all these things. Well, at least it wasn't lost. My first darshan. He tells about this and that. Did you see the interview, the video?
Yeah.
He tells about this. It was in April 1914 that I first saw him. On our way to Tirupati, my parents, uncles, and their families halted at Tiruvannamalai. Our party was about 20, including half a dozen youngsters, proceeded to Virupaksha Cave for Sri Bhagavan Darshan. I was then about 15 years old, so it's around 1900. He died around 95 years. I made my obeisance to Sri Bhagavan along with the rest. Sri Bhagavan's benign gaze was fixed on me, but I paid little attention to him as I ran about the place along with the old other boys. We found a good-sized, beautiful white conch shell inside the cave. We boys had a lot of fun blowing it. Nobody troubled to prevent us. After my return home to Tiruchirappalli, when my father was practicing as a lawyer, a great change came over me. Till then, I had never cared to go to any temple. But now I felt dragged, as if it were, by some mysterious fascination to the huge and magnificent Matabhuteshwara Lingam in the rock temple in the center of the city. I would go up the hill almost every evening. Once inside the temple, a great peace overwhelmed me, and the joy I felt was indescribable. All the same, I was, as usual, keenly interested in my studies. I was then in the SSLC class.
A senior school leaving certificate.
What? The L is what?
Leaving certificate. Senior school leaving certificate. It is 10th grade.
Leaving?
Leaving certificate.
Leaving school?
Yeah.
Notwithstanding this spiritual diversion, I maintain a high rank, taking the first place in the school in English in the SSLC examination that year. When I entered college, a further change came over me. This was noticeable during the weekly hour for English composition in the classroom. The tutor would announce the subject for composition as soon as the class assembled. Every student would finish his composition during the hour. But alas for poor me, I would just write the subject heading on the paper, sit statue-like for the whole hour, and then hand over the blank sheet to the tutor. No ripple of thought could cross my mind, which, though fully conscious, stood like a block of stone, immobile. I simply could not muster the thoughts even for a few lines, however much I wished. The above state continued for the 2 years of my intermediate class.
Wow.
I mean, you didn't...
You didn't
my composition.
How did he pass all the classes?
Yeah, how did he get through 2 years? Maybe that was just the English.
You made it just 12th grade.
Even today, it is a wonder to me how I passed the intermediate examination with just a few marks short of a first. To enable me to secure the coveted seat in the BA honors course, I had to take physics, though my original desire was to take English literature. That could not be, as I had done poorly in English, and just a pass mark. Judged from this distance of time, it looks as if I had lost the volition of free original thinking so much needed in English. Though the capacity to remember and repeat facts taken from books was not much impaired. He was a student in college of that famous Swaminathan, famous physicist.
Where? In Trichinopoly? St. Joseph's College.
And some other famous Nobel laureate or something.
C.V. Raman?
Yeah. He was a student of his later on. Although he doesn't mention that here. It was rough sailing during the years of my physics honors course. My efforts to study books brought on a very severe ache inside my brain. I would seek relief in closing my eyes and lying still most of the time I was not in class. I wonder how I got my yearly promotions. I must have been due to the kindness of my sympathetic professor through whom Sri Bhagavan's grace must have operated. Second Darshan. In January 1919, during the second year of my honors course, I had occasion to visit my sister in Tiruvannamalai. The very morning I arrived there from Tiruchirappalli, I had darshan of Sri Bhagavan at Skanda Ashram. This time also, Sri Bhagavan's gracious look was forcibly impressed on me. Returning to my sister's house after darshan, I lay down to sleep after breakfast. It was not ordinary sleep. For over 2 hours, I was fully conscious and at the same time totally unconscious of my body and its surroundings. It was with some difficulty I was roused for lunch. Even after being roused, I felt that everything around was like a dream. Of course, people around me saw my puzzled expression and made fun of me. After my return to Tiruchirappalli, I slowly recovered my ability to study. But I had to extend my 3-year course to 4 years. I was lucky to get a second in the university list when I did take the BA honors degree examination in 1921. Third Darshan. My third Darshan was about the last week of June in the year 1922. Mahatma Gandhi had started the Satyagraha movement against the British government in India. His nonviolent civil resistors were being ruthlessly beaten, killed, or imprisoned. I was angry that a person of such a high standing as Sri Bhagavan was not moving a finger for the country's liberation. You know, Professor K.
Swaminathan.
Professor K. Swaminathan said the same thing. He was a Gandhian follower. He said, what is this man doing, sitting there on the hill, doing nothing? It's in that video also. You'll see Professor K. Swaminathan. The first interview. Humiliation and suffering of the good and exaltation of the wicked was the order of the day. All this could never happen, I told myself, if there was an omniscient, benevolent, omnipotent God. This Maharshi was wasting time, uniting the hypothetical soul with another hypothetical oversoul or God. I became an agnostic, and made it my business to fight anybody who, neglecting the practicalities of life, dared to postulate the existence of a soul or God. Here was my opportunity to fight the Maharshi. Let him dare to speak a word of soul of God, or God. Gotta have it out. I went to Shyamanashram just then, shifted to the present premises where the holy remains of Sri Bhagavan's mother stand enshrined. I was accompanied by my friend, the late T.K. Sundarasa Iyer, and my brother-in-law, Kupa Swami Iyer. Sri Bhagavan was alone, seated on a bench, placed under a tree. Earlier I had told my companions that I would not prostrate before the Maharshi. But lo, a strange thing happened. The instant we reached his presence, I had fallen flat, face down before him, in the traditional mode of prostration. This, of course, caused in me some embarrassment, which, however, I soon got over. Fixing a steady look at the Maharshi, face, I jerked out my question. He didn't tell what he told in the interview there. When I saw the Maharshi, he had a dog on his lap and he was petting him. You saw that? And whatever respect I had for him left me right there. He's as a dog in our society is not considered impure. If you look at that, as soon as he says that, a dog barks behind him. Oh. In that interview?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, fixing a steady look at the Maharshi's face, I jerked up my question in Tamil. You are now sitting like this. But what is your next day? You know, in that movie, he mimics Bhagavan, he closes his eyes. What is your next day? That is after death. Stiti, here's the word. My idea was to elicit from him the reply that there is a soul which survives the dissolution of the body and gets united with the Oversoul or God so that I could fight it out and prove the contrary. Minutes passed, but no reply was forthcoming. Two pairs of eyes were interlocked in a steady gaze, and there was absolute silence. The thought barely passed within me, is this man taking shelter in this silence to avoid answering an inconvenient question? Just then, Sri Bhagavan's ringing voice exploded. You said state. What do you mean by state? If a bombshell had exploded under my seat, it could not have been so shattering as this sudden counter-question, most unexpectedly delivered. I must answer him. I began to think, well, I did not ask him about the body, which would be buried or burnt. There is something inside the body, the thinking apparatus, the so-called mind. It is about this I asked. Now, if I say that the question is about the state of the mind, he will naturally ask me to define mind, and so I must have the answer ready for such a question. So within myself I raised the inquiry, what is mind? But alas, no answer was forthcoming. My mind was paralyzed, its thought power dead. Like a helpless mute I sat. Just then there was a fierce glow in Sri Bhagavan's eyes, which held my eyes in a tight grip. A radiant smile of victory spread over his divine face. I lost sense of body and world. The insignificant I, that I was being swallowed up in pure awareness being, in which all name, form, time, space, and action were utterly lost, in a state of utter silence, aglow with self-effulgent, I am, without beginning or end. Recovering consciousness of body and surroundings, with the inner glow still effulgent, there was no more question to be asked or answered. Reveling in the joy of that thrilling defeat, I quickly prostrated and made a headlong flight. Wonder of wonders is this matchless gaze of Sri Bhagavan. How potent, how joyous. It cannot be expressed in words. From my 15th year till this day, when I'm 67, that gaze is still riveted on me, and the absorption of the ego in Arunachala Shiva Ramana, which is pure spirit, continues with ever-increasing vigor. We interviewed him, you know.
It's like a ripe soul, eh?
Yeah.
But on the surface, he was so composed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had like 45 minutes left on our videotape. And we had only one tape left, 2-hour tape, you know, for the whole thing we're doing for the whole thing. So we put the 2-hour one in so we don't have to interrupt him. We gave him a question because he said he's deaf. I had a hearing aid, but I gave it to Kundaswami because nothing comes in, only comes out. If you want me to answer any questions, write down. So we had to write down everything, you know. Back in those days, none of those old devotees would speak unless they got permission from the office. Unless the office said okay.
Oh.
You know, they were, because they're staying in the ashram. You know. Unless the president said okay, they wouldn't. So we wrote it down and we had 45 minutes left on the tape. So we said, well, let's stick with the 45 minutes. Who knows how long he's going to talk. So as soon as we got to exactly 45 minutes, he stopped.
Oh.
Then he asked me, has 45 minutes passed? Now, I didn't say anything to him.
Oh, wow.
He said, I wanted to speak for 45 minutes, he said. And he was a lecturer. Maybe he could have had an automatic clock in his mind, you know, because
maybe,
he used to
yeah.
give. But he came up with that 45 minutes without us saying anything to him. About 45 minutes left on the tape.
The tape.
A message from His Holiness Sri Rama Devi. Now, this is the guru of Shiva Kami.
Oh, okay.
Rama Devi. Yeah. She was a married woman and used to have experience, and she used to advise all the other married people. The redemptive grace of the Sadguru is the most outstanding contributory factor in spiritual unfoldment. The spiritual power activated through the mystic touch of the Master transports the consciousness of the disciple to the realm of transcendent wisdom. Maharshi Ramana personified the force and purity of spiritual silence. By his inherence in wisdom and his spontaneity and self-abidance, he revealed in himself the truth epitomized, how do you say it?
Epitomized.
In the Mahavakyas, that the soul is identical with the Absolute. Maharshi's life was a silent hymn of praise to the Supreme and a ceaseless teaching of the mystery of life and universe. In him was a wonderful blend, an all-transcending aloofness, an active sympathy for suffering souls. May his silent grace continue to inspire and illumine all the devotees and all aspiring souls who look to him for guidance. Now, as Balaram Reddy, well, we know, he's in that interview also. He took Anandamayi Ma to see Rama Devi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Anandamayi Ma visited Rama Ashram in 1953. So he said, she came and sat there, Anandamayi Ma, and then Rama Devi came into the room and she sat down and said, both of them just sat in silence, like in samadhi. No one said anything the other. I waited for an hour and then I said, let's go. No, they never said anything. So.
No, very well.
Quote from Sri Bhagavan, in a sense, speaking of self-realization is a delusion. It is only because people have been under the delusion that the non-self is the self and the unreal the real. That they have to be weaned out of it by the other delusion called self-realization. Because actually the self always is the self. And there's no such thing as realizing it. Who is to realize what and how when all that exists is the self and nothing but the self? If Bhagavan alone can say that. The White Radiance of Eternity by Professor K. Subramanian. About a quarter of a century ago, a group of four persons, myself and within the number, went to Tiruvannamalai to have our first darshan of Bhagavan. We slept overnight in the town and set out for the ashram in the morning. After the usual bath, on arriving at the entrance of the ashram grounds, we paused and surveyed what lay before us. At some distance within was a big white building that dominated the scene. In between were a number of sheds, some of which we would have to pass, and some we might have to enter. At the end of our short walk of exploration, we would arrive at the white building and there hope to have our darshan. With this plan in mind, we first entered the publication department of the ashram and then went into the ashram office. These are both connected. Now they made them into meditation rooms next to the well on the side of Bhagavan Samadhi on the north side.
Okay.
There's two rooms there.
Oh, I've seen those rooms.
They have the reading in one of the rooms.
Oh, yeah.
That was the office, and behind it was the book.
Oh,
you know, publication behind it. And both those rooms are like, you know, they have for meditation rooms now. You saw that, right?
Yeah.
Then following some persons who were moving ahead, we walked toward the adjoining shed. Our stepping across the threshold occurred the most overwhelming experience of my life. For here, just on the other side of the threshold, gazing full at us, the new arrivals was Bhagavan himself. This must have been like they called Jubilee Hall. They built 1946. Southside, we call it a shed, but outside. Nothing had prepared us to find him here. Not a whisper had escaped from within the hall. There had been no unusual gathering or movement of people outside it. But here, in perfect silence, sat Bhagavan and those who had come seeking him. He, partly sitting and partly reclining on a sofa, they, sitting facing him in rows on the floor for the whole length of the hall, not less than 50 of them, into this fellowship of serenity, seemingly waiting to receive us, we stepped in, without a moment's preparation of the mind, and were absorbed into it the same instant. It was as well that the mind had not set about preparing itself. For then, on receiving Bhagavan's gaze, it might have proceeded to respond self-consciously. Taking unawares, the mind was overwhelmed before it could even feebly affirm its existence. In its place was Bhagavan's silence, awareness, with only peace for its content. What we had hitherto called silence had been very difficult, or very different, in spite of from speech, perhaps to replenish the exhausted energy for the sake of speech yet to come, or a manner of inward chatter, a succession of jerky thoughts whose utterance was only inaudible to others. However, even such silence, if it is pervasive or prolonged, seems to most people abnormal, morbid, weird, even suggestive of danger and calamity. The story goes that King Ajatasattru of Magadha once set out to pay a visit to the Buddha, and his bhikshus, said to number more than 1,000, who were then residing in the big mango grove at a little distance from the royal capital, Rajagriha. The king, with his large retinue, approached the grove, entered it, and even proceeded into it for some distance, when panic seized him. Turning to his guide, he asked, "Surely some ambush is laid for me here, and you are leading me into it. Not a sneeze have I heard, not a clearing of the throat from that large sangha which dwells here, as you said. Men recognize normalcy only in continued speech, inward when it is not outward. Speech is the ego's customary manner of self-affirmation, its habitual satisfaction. When the ego is aggressive, speech is strident. Swearing and oaths are the ego's violent explosions. For this reason, it must have been that Jesus asked people to communicate with others with a quiet yea, yea, or nay, nay, and never to swear. But if one identifies one's being with the ego, and if the only proof of being alive which one recognizes is the mind's incessant chatter, outward or inward, How can one find true silence? Bhagavan's presence. Endurable. Our feeble intelligence can be only indirectly aware of a bright, white, smooth surface by the scribblings on it. If there is no scribble, there is no witness for us, or no whiteness for us. It was by grace that at the moment when we stepped over the threshold of that shed, our minds were not engaged in scribbling or interested in any scribble. We saw the pure whiteness in a flash. That moment vanished, but my being had been fertilized. Silence and seclusion could not fill me with dread thereafter. The life of a recluse can be more charged with power, I could at least understand, than the lives of those who shout and rush about. The distant peak is a peak, not an appearance among the clouds. Nirvana, sunyata, mindlessness, nirguna, brahman, or nirvikalpa, samadhi, are terms that need to be received and reverent with reverent attention, not with frightened bewilderment. In course of time, one might enter into the truth of Lao Tzu's saying that though 30 spokes meet the hub in the hub of the wheel, the hole, the void, at the hub center, is the wheel's raison d'être. Raison d'être.
What's it again?
Raison d'être.
Raison d'être. The reason for being. It's
French. Raison d'être. Its true use. The speech and the silence that we ordinarily know are at the same level. They are modes of each other. But Bhagavan's silence, lying deeper, could well bear both of them on its surface. A tribute from Christmas Humphreys. Apart from being the founder, president of the London Buddhist Society, Christmas Humphreys is the most widely read English writer on Buddhism today. We have pleasure in publishing this tribute he has sent us. The spiritual grandeur of the late Ramana Maharshi is unrivaled in the 20th century. Only those still bound in the limitations of some particular religion could challenge this belief, which, as a Buddhist, I have held since I first met those who had the good fortune to sit at the Master's feet. And when I read his recorded conversations with those who sought his wisdom, I recognized that conscious identity with the unborn, unoriginated, unformed, as the Buddha called, the Absolute. May I honor myself by paying humble tribute to one who left the world with such an example of attainment. So Lavanya sent the messages to WhatsApp, and I had no connection with that. That's why. And she tried calling
WhatsApp. Yeah, WhatsApp works on Wi-Fi only. We didn't have the password. She had WhatsApp, Wi-Fi, but I didn't know the password.
Yeah, I didn't bother.
Does she live in Princeton also?
Right around there.
Oh, okay.
I don't have Wi-Fi.
She was really upset.
No, the Wi-Fi connection should be wherever you are.